defense authorization bill to pump more money toward the Pentagon and overseas special operations, and through other measures is backing those operations of the CIA, basically dedicated to, whenever the order comes down, being ready to go in and overthrow democracy. So Americans are now getting a mild taste of their own medicine, in a sense.
We have five seconds.
To recognize that and fight against it. Stop.
Alan Aaron, activist and award-winning journalist, thanks so much for joining us. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Thank you, KBOO supporters, for helping us reach our end-of-the-year fundraising goal. KBOO only exists because of you, our KBOO community. So thank you for keeping these airwaves going and supporting volunteer-powered, community-supported radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon lawmakers say they're angry after a pro-Trump mob attacks the U.S. Capitol.
Because we could hear noises, my assumption, and I think all of our assumption, is that protesters did enter the building.
Protesters across the country plan to be out in force tonight, and a local group that helps homeless Native families in Portland is getting a big boost at a time when the need is great. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 7, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. A brawl in Salem yesterday as far-right-leaning groups fought with police and counter-demonstrators at a rally outside the Oregon State Capitol. The organizers had gathered the group to protest the congressional certification of the presidential election. A protester burned an effigy of Governor Kate Brown. Oregon State Police declared the gathering an unlawful assembly and ordered the protesters to disperse. Meantime, House Speaker Tina Kotek is accusing a Republican state lawmaker, Representative Mike Nierman, of enabling violent protesters to breach the Capitol building while the state legislature met in their special session in December. Kotek says Nierman opened a door to allow demonstrators in, which he calls a serious breach of public trust. At least four people were arrested related to the protest gathering at the Capitol. Oregon's lawmakers are reacting to the violence that broke out during the presidential election certification. Many members of Congress from Oregon said they were angry about the protesters breaching the U.S. Capitol. Eric Tegedoff has more.
protesters stormed the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday while Congress was certifying the results of the 2020 election. The pro-Trump crowd was in Washington, D.C. to oppose the election outcome. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley was in the Senate chamber when the proceedings were halted. He describes the moment when a staffer stopped the certification process.
Nobody runs on the floor of the chamber. Certainly nobody runs up to the dais. Certainly nobody interrupts a speech. So all of that was very, very sudden, very unusual. And because we could hear noises, my assumption, and I think all of our assumption, is that protesters had entered the building.
Oregon's other Senator Ron Wyden called the event a direct assault on democracy. And Representative Earl Blumenauer says it was clearly an act of terrorism. One person was shot and killed after protesters breached the Capitol, although the circumstances of the shooting are unclear. Protesters supporting President Donald Trump also gathered in Oregon's Capitol. Merkley says before the interruption, senators were immersed in the election certification process.
We were all there in the chamber listening to each other, which is so rare for the Senate. And each senator is limited to 5 minutes. We had a very powerful initial speech by Mitch McConnell speaking to his vision of the Constitution. And it was a speech that could have been delivered by someone of either party in defense of our constitutional responsibility.
Merkley adds that Americans should use this as an opportunity to think about democracy in this country.
We really need to take this moment to reflect on how to strengthen our institutions that have been so damaged over the 4 years of the Trump administration.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Protesters unfurled a banner over Interstate 110 in Los Angeles, which reads, "Trump lost." That's just one example. At this hour, progressive groups are mobilizing across the country to protest what they call the pro-Trump chaos. Suzanne Potter has more in the story.
Progressive groups are calling for mass protests across the nation at 5 p.m. today, where they say activists will call for immediate action to remove President Donald Trump from office. On Wednesday, the president held a rally, and afterward, thousands of his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol building in an attempt to stop the official acceptance of state's electoral votes in favor of President-elect Joe Biden. Coco Das, with the group RefuseFascism.org, thinks Trump has been calling for what amounts to a coup for months.
Whether or not it succeeds, it's extremely dangerous, and it's laying the groundwork for ongoing attacks on elections and the fascist reseizure of power. We call this a fascist coup because that's what it is.
Demonstrations popped up in many cities across the U.S. on Wednesday, and the group Refuse Fascism is calling on people to take to the streets today, asking them to bang pots and pans at downtown locations at 5 p.m. local time to demand that President Trump step down. The group Indivisible also released a statement calling on Congress to impeach Trump once again, remove him from office, and disqualify him from ever holding office again. President Trump, in a video message, called on supporters to go home peacefully, but he continued to claim that the election was rigged. Das believes too many people have stood by thus far, ignoring the threats posed by some people who believe the false claims.
In the first few hours of an attempted coup, which is what this was, what the people do is really important. And if we don't stand up and oppose it, then anything is possible. But if we do stand up and oppose it, the same is true. Anything is possible. Trump could be forced to resign tomorrow.
On Wednesday in Los Angeles, protesters draped an anti-Trump banner above an overpass in downtown while a car caravan circled City Hall in San Francisco. Some protesters voiced fear that President Trump will try to invoke the Insurrection Act and declare martial law. Others are asking leaders to invoke the 25th Amendment to declare President Trump unfit for office and replace him with Vice President Mike Pence until Biden is sworn in on January 20th. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Pro-Trump supporters broke into the Capitol, delaying members of Congress from completing the presidential electoral vote count. And Democrats won both of Georgia's U.S. Senate seats. With more on these stories, here's today's edition of 2020 Talks.
They failed to attempt to obstruct the Congress. This failed insurrection only underscores how crucial the task before us is for our republic.
Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell of Kentucky made clear Congress was undeterred yesterday evening when he called out the mob of Trump supporters that stormed the Capitol in an effort to stop the Electoral College vote count. Thousands listened to President Donald Trump speak before marching to the Capitol, where scores mobbed the building, broke windows, got past armed guards, and entered both the House and Senate, looting and causing the people locked down inside to call their loved ones and even fear for their lives. Four people have died, one an Air Force veteran. Law enforcement eventually secured the Capitol, but observers noted that treatment of rioting protesters, mostly white people, was markedly softer than what past Black Lives Matter activists have received. Freshman Congresswoman Cori Bush, a Black representative from Missouri, called it racist. Many groups who organized the protest promote white supremacism, and President Trump is accused of egging on their behavior. Tara, from Detroit, is white. She defends Trump. At the protest yesterday, she spoke to the radio program OurBodyPolitic.show before the protest turned violent.
I don't believe that he's racist or that he doesn't believe that something is happening. But the way that they've locked us down, and now in Michigan, I'm locked down. We're locked down. We're not sick. We're not sick and we're not racist. And I think that he's the same way.
Along with many others, President-elect Joe Biden urged Trump to denounce the violence.
To storm the Capitol, to smash windows, to occupy offices, threatening the safety of duly elected officials. It's not protest. It's insurrection.
Soon afterwards, Trump heeded the call and addressed the crowd. Still, he repeated falsehoods about the election, despite losing by more than 7 million votes, and praised the protesters.
This was a fraudulent election, but we can't play into the hands of these people. We have to have peace. So go home. We love you.
The president's Twitter account was blocked for 12 hours. Twitter threatened to block it permanently if Trump continued posting false allegations of election fraud and inciting violence. The National Association of Manufacturers is calling on Vice President Mike Pence to work with cabinet members to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove Trump. Vermont Governor Republican Phil Scott says Trump should resign or be removed. In Georgia, Democrat John Ossoff eked out a victory against incumbent Georgia Republican Senator David Perdue, giving Democrats control of the U.S. Senate. Here's Ossoff.
I will look forward to serving you in the United States Senate with integrity, with humility, with honor, and getting things done for the people of Georgia.
Finally, Biden is expected to pick Merrick Garland as his attorney general. Republicans blocked Garland's Supreme Court nomination in 2016. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum.
A Somali refugee who's worked to empower the powerless has won the right to represent Oregonians in the state Senate. Casey Jama will represent a district including East Portland and Northern Clackamas County. He is a founder and director of Unite Oregon, a nonprofit that works for immigrants, people of color, and low-income families and children. 9 out of 10 commissioners from Multnomah and Clackamas County selected Jama as the strongest nominee for the position. Jama will take the Senate seat that Shamia Fagan is leaving, as she's been elected Oregon's new Secretary of State. He will be the third Black member of the Oregon Senate this year, along with Lou Frederick of Portland and James Manning Jr. of Eugene. Jama also makes history as the first Muslim to serve in the Oregon Senate. Portland City Council has given the green light to a plan to pump millions into affordable housing and economic development. Supporters hope the $67 million plan will help families that have been displaced from the city's historically Black neighborhoods. The city's four commissioners, including two who are African American, say it's a step toward righting the wrongs of racist anti-Black policies. Commissioner Mingus Mapps describes it as a painful history that's left the community scarred. And Commissioner Joanne Hardesty says, quote, "We have a lot of work to do to create a city that is equitable and fair for all of us." The new plan will pay for building 40 to 50 new single-family homes and at least 300 apartments. People whose families were pushed out of the North and Northeast Portland area by the city some 50 years ago would have priority to live in them. The Oregon Department of Corrections confirms that two inmates have died after becoming infected with COVID-19. Both men are older than 70. This brings the total number of inmates who lost their lives during the outbreak to 25 in the state. At the same time, over the past week, Oregon COVID cases jumped 17% to more than 7,900 for the last week alone. The latest information from the Oregon Health Authority also shows more than 4,800 active COVID-19 outbreaks in care facilities, living communities, and long-term care facilities. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a demonstration against the war in Ethiopia. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with rain overnight, a low down to 43. And tomorrow's weather, we're looking at some rain in the morning, giving way to partly cloudy skies by mid-afternoon, a high of 49. This weekend's looking partly cloudy and chilly, some lows near the freezing mark. Today in history, on January 7, 1789, Congress set the date by which states were required to choose electors for the country's first ever presidential election. A month later, George Washington was elected president and was sworn into office in April. The quote of the day is from George Washington, who said, "It is better to offer no excuse than a bad one." Joining us is Paul Lumley. He's the executive director of the Native American Youth and Family Center here in Portland. Welcome, Paul.
Hello.
The center in Portland's just gotten a $5 million grant from the Day One Families Fund to help solve family homelessness. Tell us how this happened.
Well, I received an email. It actually went to my spam filter, and I sent it to my IT guy, and I asked him if it was legitimate because it didn't seem real. I was being offered an opportunity to apply for a $5 million grant. And he said, no, it's legitimate. So we opened it up, and there you go.
Wow, that must have been a happy surprise there.
It sure was.
When is the center going to get this money, and what is it going to be used for?
Well, we already have the funds, and we're going to be using these resources to really move the needle on the Native homelessness situation in Portland, Oregon, which is pretty bad, and it's getting worse.
Describe it to me. Like, what are some of the main issues there, and how many folks are in trouble?
The Native American population in Portland is about 2.5% by census, yet of the homeless population, 12.5% are Native American, which means we're overrepresented by 5 times compared to any other group. And of these folks who are homeless, over 50% are what's called chronically homeless, meaning they've been living in the streets for over a year and have one or more disabling conditions. And it's actually much worse than just a couple of years ago, so it's just not getting better. And this funding that's coming through right now is so timely, especially during this pandemic.
Now, let's talk a bit about that, too. I wanted to ask you how the COVID epidemic is affecting Native American kids and families in the Portland area.
It was pretty difficult even before the pandemic, but after the whole pandemic started and the crisis and everything shut down, we had a lot of people lose their jobs. And we were serving a population already that was needy, and suddenly we had major issues with people who couldn't pay their rent, couldn't pay their bills, major food insecurity. And our campus in Northeast Portland feeds a lot of people, but you can't come to our campus anymore. So we had to reformat our entire model, and now we produce food in our commercial kitchen and deliver it into the community where these people need it the most. And we are really surprised about the number of people who have become homeless, and we're giving them emergency food supplies at a rate that we've never seen before.
And isn't it true that there are proportionately more Native Americans are getting COVID too, right?
Yeah, that's really alarming. People of color in general, but the Native population seems to be among those getting pretty high rates of disease transmission, and those who get it are getting really sick.
What are some of the factors of why it's spreading faster and why it's making people sicker?
I think the main reason why it's spreading faster is because we tend to live intergenerationally. We have grandparents and parents and kids all living under one roof, and overcrowding. We have way too many people living in small, cramped places just because of people being so under income and really struggling to meet all their needs. And so people live in large situations and try to help each other, which is a good thing. But when you get a pandemic like this, it just allows the virus to spread more quickly.
You know about the census issues, that there's a controversy involving the way the census is taken. It's gone to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided to dismiss a challenge to President Trump's plan to exclude people living in the country illegally from the population count, which is used to allot state seats in the House of Representatives. And they also stopped the count early. And there was a lot of pushback among Native groups saying that a lot of times they're not counted accurately in the census, or it's tougher to make sure that they're included and that they fear that they're not going to count. And a lot of the resources that they're depending on are not going to be there because of that.
Well, you know, I hadn't heard about the Supreme Court decisions. We are very close to the immigrant community here in Portland, and we all support each other. Oftentimes, it's just a line on a map that separates us as people. We're still indigenous. So as to the census count in Indian country, it is difficult because oftentimes our tribal people, they live in really remote locations and they just don't trust the government. They don't want that kind of intrusion. And so it's hard to get people to participate. That's why it's really important to have the Census Bureau hire Native people to go into the Native community and help them get counted. And we did that this year.
Mm-hmm. Are you fearful that they're going to exclude people that could count towards Oregon getting an extra member of Congress or getting some extra funds to help with some of these issues?
Well, that was certainly a danger. I can't really comment on the Supreme Court decision because I haven't read anything about it. You're telling me about it for the first time, but it is welcome news.
All right. Is there anything else that's going on at the Family Center, the Native American Family Center, that you'd like people to know about?
Well, we are really struggling right now with not having enough resources to serve the community in ways that they need. And we did get quite a few resources from various municipalities, the state, the government. We got resources from the state, the city, and the county, and a lot of this is federal pass-through money. But it came so fast that we actually couldn't hire new staff to get all these resources out, and we could do more if we had more staffing. But a lot of times these funds come through so fast, and they don't allow us to staff up. And so we could actually be delivering more. We just don't have the capacity right now, and so we're struggling with the staff we do have. I think we probably tripled our amount of funds that we've been able to push out into the community in terms of emergency energy and rental assistance and food, but the need is great. It is huge.
Describe to me, like, with this $5 million grant that we talked about at the beginning, how is that money going to help, like, say, one individual person?
Well, it's designed to help Native American families, and so we'll be working with people of all ages who are in family situations. I'm really surprised at how many homeless youth we have right now. You know, we have a Native American high school on campus called Many Nations Academy, and a couple of years ago, 45% were homeless. And for those kids that we were serving, more than 50% were family units. So we have a lot of young families out there that are really struggling. And so if we are going to use these funds, which are just starting to roll out now, the first thing we would do is try to divert families from entering a shelter or becoming unsheltered, and we swoop in with our wraparound case management. We already have that on campus, and help them with all of their obstacles, and rehouse families that are experiencing homelessness. So, this is going to be huge because, you know, the funding that we do get right now for serving the homeless has a lot of strings attached to it. And this funding we can use however we want. So we can serve Native families in ways that we couldn't before. We're struggling to manage them in our community because our community tends to be intergenerational. And it's difficult to navigate those existing programs with intergenerational families.
So how many people are we talking about you serving who are homeless right now? And how does it compare with pre-COVID numbers? I'm trying to just get an idea of how much the problems increase.
We're probably serving maybe 100 families right now in one capacity or another. Most of them are in our youth program. And so we do have funding from the county and the city for dealing with homeless youth. That's primarily where our focus is. So this day one family fund money is going to help us branch out into the adult family situation.
And do you see this money, are you going to be giving checks out to people or clothing and food or paying for rent, or how would it be dispersed?
Yes to all of that. It'll depend on what the family's needs are. You know, we had some summer programming over the summer. One of our Native youth came back and we found out that they had become newly homeless. The father lost his job right away and the mother got the virus and then she couldn't work anymore and they became homeless. And he just happened to mention that to us. And so we came in right away, got them into a hotel right away. And then we gave them some of our food from our kitchen because the hotel just has a little kitchenette. And they had kids, other kids too. And then we eventually worked with our resources to get them into stable housing, which is where they're at today. And we have helped the father get a job. So, you know, these are the kind of wraparound services that we need to get people to become more stably housed. And every family is different, but for that family, we were able to come in and help them.
That sounds wonderful. I'm glad you're able to do that. Oh, you mentioned the high school. Where is that school and what's the name of the school that serves the...
It's on campus. Our campus is located in Northeast Portland, Oregon. It's on Columbia Boulevard, kind of near the airport. And we purchased a middle school in 2007. And so we have a Native American high school there, which is named the Many Nations Academy, and we're a part of the public school system, and so we end up getting a lot of Native American kids that come to us that are having difficulty getting quality education or for just really being harassed in the public school system. And it's anybody that comes to our school will accept them. We're 95% communities of color, majority Native American. We have a really high percentage of LGBTQ students because they're being bullied in the school system. And I always wanted to make sure that I provide these kids with a place that they can come that's not just safe, but a place where we can honor them. So we have a pretty high percentage that are transgender as well. And so I experienced difficult childhood myself. I was homeless. I was gay. I was bullied in the school system. And so I am so proud to offer a service to the Native kids now that they can get what I didn't get when I was growing up.
That's amazing. Yeah. Tell me about your personal story. That sounds really interesting, too. Where you came from and what life was like for you growing up?
Well, I was, I'm a citizen of the Yakima Nation. I was born and raised on the reservation. Went to the Columbia River a lot for fishing. We're a fishing family. And pretty unstable, moving around quite a bit. The family unit, and then after my parents divorced, ran into problems in high school, got bullied pretty bad for being gay and wasn't supported at home, so I ran away from home and didn't go back, and so I had a really difficult childhood, and I bounced around, still fished on the river, around the Olympia area, a little bit in Seattle, eventually got into college and pushed my way through college and got a degree in mathematics, and ended up working in the science field for a while, went to Washington, D.C., did some very different things, and eventually ended up at the Native American Youth and Family Center.
Wow, amazing. What an amazing story. Wow, I'm so glad you told me about that. Great. Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't talked about?
Well, our needs are great, and if anybody wants to help us, you can go to our website. It's at nayapdx.org. That's NAYAPDX.org. And we have different ways you can learn about the services we offer if anybody wants to come and see if they need our help, and then if anybody wants to help our resource with our resources, they can also donate.
Oh, is there any word about vaccinations? I knew there was one more thing, vaccinations for the Native American population in our area.
Well, we've been working primarily on testing for the virus and also providing flu vaccinations. We just started having conversations with the county about collaborating on COVID vaccinations, and it's just, those conversations are just starting. It's going to be several more weeks before we can offer that to the Native community, and it's really up to how the state and the county and other municipalities want to prioritize different groups, but we do hope that the Native American population will be prioritized.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The D.C. Native community checks on the safety of others during a very violent day in the nation's capital. And the Shawnee tribe in Oklahoma will continue with a CARES Act lawsuit. With those stories and more, here's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily report dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
Members of the Native community in the Washington, D.C. area checked in on one another Wednesday after President Trump's supporters violently stormed the U.S. Capitol. The Navajo Nation Washington office is a short walk from the Capitol. Executive Director Santi Lewis says her employees were teleworking. They also reached out to friends and Congress staff and Native community members.
First, I want to assure the friends and family of our team at the Navajo Nation Washington office that we are all safe. What we are all witnessing is shameful, and my staff and I are horrified by the anger, the lawlessness, and the attack on our democracy. And so I wanted to ensure that our staff was safe, and so out of an abundance of caution, all my staff were asked to stay home today. And we all never imagined that something like this could happen.
The six Indigenous members of Congress from New Mexico, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Hawaii publicly announced their safety during the lockdown of the Capitol, condemning the violence. Congress later got back to work certifying Joe Biden the winner of the U.S. presidential election. Tribal leaders across the country were appalled by the violent events, including leaders of the Navajo Nation. Wednesday was a special day for Navajo people as they welcomed into office chapter officials and other local leaders. January 6th is a peaceful day for many of the pueblos in New Mexico, practicing traditions for King's Day, a time when Pueblo people welcome in new leaders to office. The celebratory day was largely overshadowed by the violence in Washington, with a woman fatally shot at the Capitol. Michigan environmental regulators' decision to grant a controversial wetlands permit for an open-pit mine on the banks of the Menominee River on the Michigan-Wisconsin border was revoked in a ruling this week by a Michigan judge. The Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin says the mine threatens water, the environment, and would have negative impacts on sacred sites. Danielle Kading has more.
Michigan regulators issued the permit to Toronto-based Aquila Resources with conditions that the company provide updated groundwater and wetland modeling before building the Golden Zinc Mine. That would be used to show the project's potential impacts. But a Michigan administrative law judge revoked the permit, saying the company's model wasn't reliable for identifying effects on wetlands. Earth Justice attorney Jeanette Brimmer represents the Menominee tribe.
It is not fine to not have an understanding and discuss that with the public and the regulators about what's going to happen here. And I think they didn't want to do it because there's going to be a big effect.
Dale Burry with the Coalition to Save the Menominee River says the project threatens the environment, property owners, and tourism.
There's just so many attributes to the river that, we just have to protect it no matter what.
Aquila CEO and President Barry Hildred says the company is weighing its options, including an appeal to Michigan's Environmental Permit Review Panel. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
The Shawnee tribe's lawsuit over federal COVID-19 aid will continue. The D.C. Court of Appeals this week overturned a motion to dismiss, which keeps the case alive. The Oklahoma tribe claims it was shortchanged CARES Act dollars due to the federal formula used to determine distribution to tribes. KJRH-TV reports the tribe received $100,000, but claims payment should be in the millions. $8 billion was set aside in the CARES Act for tribes. A number of tribes have claimed similar issues with CARES Act funding and a number of other problems. The Shawnee tribe will now go back to court. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 7th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Native Voice One and Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us for the KBOO Evening News. Stay right here for KBOO News In-Depth, coming up next.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
In a region of Ethiopia, a war is being waged against the country's own citizens in the northern region of Tigray. Government forces have attacked the ethnic minority that lives there and driven tens of thousands into neighboring Sudan as refugees since the war began in early November. Telecommunications have been blacked out for 60-plus days. The violence has also been helped by military forces from Ethiopia's northern neighbor and former foe, Eritrea. I spoke with two members of the Tigray Committee of Portland. They're organizing a demonstration tomorrow, Friday, January 8th, to call attention to the violence and demand action.
My name is Abi Tika, and I'm a member of the Tikaro Professional Network. I am also a blogger and a student of public health, so I am currently advocating for family and friends and the people of Tigray who have been silenced.
My name is Daniel Waldo. I'm also an activist who, on my spare time, works to help the people of Tigray, and especially in this dire time that we're in. Been advocating for the international community to kind of listen to what's going on, especially with the telecom blackout that's happening in Tigray, trying to put out information that may be helpful for international communities to act.
So you are both part of the Tigray Committee of Portland, and on Friday, January 8th, your group is organizing a demonstration to call attention to the war in Tigray and demand action.
Tigray is a region of Ethiopia that is being attacked by Ethiopian forces with help from the neighboring country of Eritrea. What can you tell me about the conflict?
So basically, we are on day 65 of the war on Tigray. And this is, this started out, right? The prime minister, the unelected prime minister's narrative has been that this is a law enforcement operation, that there was no other choice, that this was absolutely necessary to take these measures on to declare war, specifically on the region of Tigray, which is the northernmost region of Ethiopia, which also happens to be the smallest ethnic group in Ethiopia. It is about 6% of the total population. So that's just important contextually to kind of visualize what is happening. And so from the onset, there's been, actually months prior, there's been multiple analysts calling attention to kind of contextualizing this as a Cold War months prior and actually a couple years prior with the onset of the transitional government of Dr. Abiy Ahmed. And so there are tensions rising. And in part, just to give a little bit of backstory, in part that was because there was multiple subjugation attempts by the, you know, the federal government. Basically, yeah, so I just want to contextualize this in kind of the proper way, because there's been a wrong narrative that this began on November 4th. This was, you know, this has been a Cold War and tensions have been building. So yeah, to make that clear, there, the regional government of Tigray has been saying that they are open to peaceful dialogue. That has been rejected from the federal government. And what really set this off, I would say, is the region of Tigray decided to hold their own elections. Because Dr. Abiy Ahmed stated that there was no way that Ethiopia would be able to hold their elections due to COVID-19 restrictions. So in that case, they decided that, you know, there's no constitutional ground to indefinitely postpone. At that point, it was indefinite. There was no set date. So they rejected that and they held their own regional elections, and they did that successfully without creating any COVID hotspots. So they did that successfully, and that really angered Dr. Abiy Ahmed's administration, and that kind of escalated things a lot. So that's kind of where we're at, but now we're 65 days into this war, and it's the worst possible things that are happening to human beings. And I don't say that lightly. It's been a total war waged in the dark. There's been communication blockades, electrical blackouts, banks closed, ethnic profiling. Just within 3 weeks of this war, there were upwards of 40,000 people already in Sudan just from the onset of November 4th. So imagine that many people fleeing from their homes in that short amount of time. Now I think the number is closer to like 64,000 or 60. Upwards of 60,000 for sure. So it just keeps escalating and escalating and escalating. And another important point to make, this is my final point to your question, this is a collective punishment on Tigray. This is not a law enforcement operation. There's been numerous accounts of ethnic profiling outside of the region of Tigray, just based off of names, right? So if you have an ethnically Tigrayan sounding name, there's been house raids, arrests, profiling at the airport, people have been denied boarding, and it's systematic. It's not happening to any other group besides Tigray on that front. And lastly, I just want to say, in November, Genocide Watch declared Ethiopia a stage 9 extermination. So it's really quite escalated. It's gotten really, really bad.
Very good. Abby, you did a wonderful job of explaining the different things that have taken place. But I want to add in the involvement of the Eritrean troops to this and the UAE drones. Now, this the relationship between Ethiopia and Eritrea was restored in 2018 from the longstanding no peace, no war status when Abiy Ahmed came to power. And at the time, the peace treaty, as they called it, was signed between the two governments, and the roads and kind of the arrangements between the two peoples on the border, which is primarily the Tigrayans and the Eritreans, were opened initially and got shut off. Eventually, that led to the relationship between Eritrea and Ethiopia being solely on Abiy Ahmed and Isaias Afwerki. These are the leaders of the two countries at the time. What this indicate, or what this started off, is a relationship where both of them were kind of working together to come up with a way to attack Tigray, the Tigrayan leadership, just Tigray in general, because they both see Tigrayans as common enemy. Now, for Abiy Ahmed, subjugating Tigrayans is a way for him to prolong his power. And for Isaias Afwerki, is a vengeance from historically the war from 98 to 2000. So both of them having this as a common ground to mobilize have been seen numerous times, and this is something that is openly available to see, kind of attending each other's military bases. You'd see Isaias Afwerki in a bizarre look in history, to see a foreign entity coming in to view and kind of take pictures in the Air Force bases in Ethiopia. And then you have the Ethiopian Prime Minister going to the training facility for Eritrean troops, Sawa. And the hostilities, the conversations, the talks that have been going on for the last 2.5 years, almost 3 years now, were directly attacking and kind of making the Tigrayans look like the evil that you should exterminate from the world. And based on that, when that election happened in September of 2020, that just pushed everything overboard. And there are recordings of Abiy Ahmed saying kids would die, mothers would cry because of having this election. Now, in any country in the world where someone is, you know, looking forward or doing elections, having a democratic process, that is not the language that you would expect a leader to use. I think this is something that we, as Americans, value the most, to make sure that, you know, the world has election processes that help it to become more democratic, so that people are not exposed to dictators, authoritarians, and such. So all of that has happened. The leadership in Tigray has expressed its frustration with what is coming from the federal government to more than 60 nations in an open letter, also available online, including the AU, EU, and other big stakeholders. And so this war had a war in on it well before early November. So that's something that has to be very, very clear. Now, since the war started, many of the things that are happening outside of what Abiy has said, it's now a war on the people of Tigray. It's open. It's easy to see. There had been no way of getting anything in or out of Tigray. So people are starving. So imagine 65 days of not having any kind of any goods that need to come in and then with the banks being closed, people don't have access to their money in order to go out there and buy things that they need, if there are things that they can actually buy. And so what we're seeing now is people starving to death, people are fleeing, and people are dying. And now on top of that, what you're seeing is Eritrean troops as well as Ethiopian troops kind of looting assets from factories, individuals, killing people that have any kind of goods in their homes, and transporting that to Eritrea. and to the Amhara region. What this is doing is the very little that the people of Tigray have is being taken away, and they're being exposed to basically just dying in this in a dark.
What has the reaction been from the international community?
In terms of the international community, people have been speaking out in terms of the UN, the Secretary General, and the EU as well has actually withheld budgets, I believe, to for certain aid because they don't agree with what is transpiring. And in my purview, there's just a lot of people who, one, don't even know where Tigray is in terms of America. So speaking about like the global consensus, people are struggling to even get the news in general, which is why we're so happy that you're talking with us and giving us this opportunity to speak on your platform, because this is something that the international community definitely needs to know. More people need to know, not just politicians, but every regular person, especially those who value, like Danny said, you know, our values as you know, living in America, people with democratic values. This is a horrific attack on you know, those institutions. Even yesterday, we're seeing what happened is a gross attack on our very institutions and the pillars of constitutional federal republic. So people, in my experience, when they know what's happening, they do care. They see how horrible it is, and they actually want to help and get involved. But it's just so hard to get the correct messaging out when you also are up against a full-blown propaganda machine within Ethiopia. We're talking state-sponsored media. There's a monopoly on the telecommunications. So that means when you call into Ethiopia, your calls are recorded and they're replayed back in your ear, like 2-minute intervals or so. So that's also another issue that we're seeing with, you know, selective regions, their communications back on, people who have been able to contact their family after 55 days or so. There's not really much that can be detailed, but the news that we have gotten is just completely gruesome. So to your point, to sum it up, I would say that the internet people from the international community, politicians, the larger population at general, they do care, and they see how wrong this is, what is happening in Ethiopia and Tigray. It's just a matter of getting the word out and timely, because developments are progressing in a really grotesque, rapid manner.
Just to add to that, and I think she summed up well, but what we're seeing is that the world is concerned. And I think we are beyond where we could be concerned for the people of Tigray. Because 65 days of not having the basic things that you would need to live exposes you to death if you're not killed or shot by forces of different caliber. So I think from the international community, we have seen concerns, but it needs to be more than that. There needs to be some action. There needs to be some resolutions put together from the UN, Security Council, and the U.S. government needs to press on the government of Ethiopia to, you know, withdraw the troops, to let humanitarian aid go in into Tigray to assist people who need it. Mind you, a lot of everything in terms of pharmaceutical needs, medicine, has been looted. So anyone who have gunshot wounds or people who are in need of medications are not able to receive any. And so there are people just dying from the lack of having medicine. So having the humanitarian aid go in, forcing that process to happen, is going to be the most prompt thing that we need to do. So action is needed. And the international community has not acted yet. They have shown their concerns. They have shown that what they're seeing is appalling. But at the same time, we need to, our efforts now is to make sure that the international community acts.
So the Tigray Committee of Portland is holding a demonstration tomorrow morning. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, absolutely. So we will be meeting at Pioneer Square in downtown Portland to raise awareness obviously we were going to engage in a peaceful protest. And this is in Portland, this is in D.C., in Denver, Austin, the Bay Area. It's actually an international protest. So in Germany, Australia, all over the world, you know, Tagaro and allies, people standing in solidarity with humanity, basically, are joining us to, you know, call attention to the horrific circumstances that are plaguing the people of Tigray. So our main objectives is to make people aware who aren't aware, and also urge people to join us in calling to action. Just like Danny was saying, it's so important that we are being very clear that what our asks are, and that we want the U.S. to intervene. We want the U.N. to intervene. People are going to continue to die, and it's at the point where people are starving to death. Really grotesque, just murders, ethnic-based and religious-based killings are taking place. So we're asking for an immediate cessation of all forms of hostilities waged against all people of the country, unfettered humanitarian aid access, and the protection of all aid workers. That's really important. By the way, there's trucks at the borders outlined. They have this, there's a lot of supplies that can't get in because the federal government will not let them in. So additionally, the UN Security Council lead an independent investigation into war crimes and heinous crimes against humanity. That's a really important one as well. We don't specifically want amnesty or the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, which is also sponsored by the state, to necessarily continue to conduct these investigations without independent corroboration. So it's important that the UN specifically leads this. And for ultimately, you know, peace for the region and a comprehensive discourse and dealings between both federal and regional governments and all stakeholders to restore telecommunications and essential utilities in Tigray. So yeah, the protests will be to elaborate what is happening and how people can get involved to help.
The one thing that I want to add to that is from the starting point, we would be heading to Senator Jeff Merkley's office so that we can deliver maybe a handwritten notes or any kind of information that we think his office should be aware of. And, you know, so if we can get any kind of coverage at the protest, we would really appreciate it. But the protest will be tomorrow morning, tomorrow midday-ish.
So if our listeners are interested in supporting you or learning more about this war, what is the best way for them to do that?
That's a great question. So there's multiple pages. There's many nonpartisan things that people can do, whether it be for information or specific action items. You can go to linktree.com/IStandWithTigray, and there you will find a series of things you can do to stand in solidarity with us. There's tweet templates for our Twitter campaigns. You can petition, call to action and peaceful resolution, petition to protect the UNESCO heritage sites. They're currently being looted. You can help the doctors and the health professionals out there. We have fundraisers for them. So there's so many resources within this link tree. Again, that is linktree-IStandWithTigray. And then as far as social media goes, there's a couple pages on Instagram people can follow. There's Tagaro PN, the Tigray Youth Network, the Humans of Tigray, Humans_of_Tigray, the Uprooted podcast. And for anybody who's looking for more context and a recap of the last 65 days, you can head over to @newmediasocialchange. And you can click on the highlights, part one and two, to get an idea of what has been happening since November 4th.
Yeah, but on top of that, there are a lot of articles that have been written, accounts of refugees from Sudan. So you will be able to collect a lot of information from the international media by itself just to get the basis. But the social media that you indicated are also very detailed information. The only other one that I can add in is Omna Tigray, Omna being O-M-N-A, TIGRAY on Instagram has like a historical kind of points to factor in when trying to understand the complex situation in the Tigray region in comparison to other regions. But I think if you were to type in Tigray in a lot of places that are coming in from Tigrayan perspective, you would understand it. Now, there are also going to be a lot of misinformation. So that's something that, you know, people need to be mindful of. There are, it seems like, ethnicities in different parts of Ethiopia that won't see the worst happen in Tigray. And with that, you will see a dismissal of this being a war, a dismissal of people being killed, massacred in different parts. So a lot of people need to be aware of the sources in which they're reading from. But I think there's a lot of content out there for the last 65 days that covers what has been taking place.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I do, actually. So I just want to piggyback off of what Danny said. I think it's a really important point that you will see a lot of contrasting and competing narratives. And I just want to make it clear, at least speaking for me, and I can probably speak for all of our cohort, we care about people. We want people to be safe, human beings, right? So we're advocating for our friends and family, but we would also urge Americans and the global community to think of the macro implications of what the destabilization of Ethiopia would look like, what that could mean for the rest of the world. You know, experts, these aren't my words, but experts, you know, have been warning, for instance, the statement on Ethiopia by the Senior Study Group on Peace and Security in the Red Sea Arena published on Thursday, November 5th of 2020. And I quote, as we cautioned in the study group's final report and recommendations released on October 29th, the fragmentation of Ethiopia would be the largest state collapse in modern history. Ethiopia is five times the size of pre-war Syria by population, and its breakdown would lead to mass inter-ethnic and inter-religious conflict, a dangerous vulnerability to exploitation by extremists, and acceleration of illicit trafficking, including arms, and a humanitarian and security crisis at the crossroads of Africa and the Middle East on a scale that would overshadow any existing conflict in the region, including Yemen. As Ethiopia is currently leading troop contributing country to the United Nations and the African Union, peacekeeping missions in Sudan, South Sudan, and Somalia, its collapse would also significantly impact the efforts by both to mitigate and resolve other conflicts in the Horn of Africa. So when we're thinking about the ecological impact, the influx of refugees and asylum seekers pouring out of a country with 110 million people, it's just unfathomable. And that's where a lot of experts are saying is likely, if not, you know, doomed if there isn't intervention. So I hope that everybody considers the macro implications as well.
That's an important case to make for what's going on and how this can transition something bigger than what it seems like on the ground right now. And so it's important that, you know, for the interest of America or the interest of the world, a peace-loving world, there is a peaceful, you know, peaceful solution to this mayhem, this senseless war that we're in. Again, I want to go back to what we are wanting to come out of this. One, we just want our families and friends to be safe, to be the humanitarian aid to go in so that they're not dying from starvation and they're not dying from a lack of medicine. What we're asking for are the basic things that a human being would ask, nothing more. And so this is not something that's debatable. This is not something that we can go back and forth with. This is not up for a dialogue. Now, when it comes to the two governments that don't agree on the future of Ethiopia, they can have a peaceful dialogue, and the UN and other stakeholders should be facilitating that to make sure that civilians are, you know, not put on harm's way, and we're doing the best that we can to make sure that the resolution or the solutions that we come with are solutions that don't endanger the average civilians. And so this protest is primarily to put a spotlight on the genocide that's taking place in Tigray and how to end it. And hopefully we can get our Oregon citizens to stand behind it.
Thank you both so much for speaking with me today.
That was my conversation with Daniel Woldu and Abby Tekka from the Tigray Committee of Portland. Their group is holding a demonstration in downtown Portland tomorrow, Friday, January 8th at 11 a.m. at Pioneer Square. Find more information on their Linktree at linktr.ee/istandwithtigray, spelled T-I-G-R-A-Y. We will also have those links on our website at kbu.fm. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication